Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In 1959, NASA announced the selection of the Mercury 7, America's first astronauts. The seven men would undergo a grueling battery of tests before their missions.
During this time, our urgent goal is to subject these gentlemen to every stress, each unusual environment they will experience in that flight.
Turns out they weren't the only ones about to be subjected to unusual stress. The wives of these seven men became overnight celebrities, drafted as the de facto public relations arm of NASA. They had to project the image of a perfect American family as they worried privately over risks to their husbands and their marriages. This hour on Point, the Astronaut Wives Club. You can join us on air or online. Do you know anything about these women beyond the beehives and lipstick? What do you think it must have been like? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Later this hour, we'll talk about the Mercury 13, the women who underwent testing to become astronauts at the very dawn of the space age. But first, joining me now from New York City is Lily Capel. She's author of the new book, The Astronaut Wives Club, A True Story. Lily Capel, welcome to On Point.
Thank you so much for having me.
So tell us what brought you to the Astronaut Wives as a book idea.
Absolutely. Well, I really stumbled upon it by chance. I'm a big fan of space, but not really a space geek. You know, I've read the right stuff. I've watched the movie Apollo 13. But I'm really a journalist who's dedicated to telling never-before-told, mostly women's stories. And I was sitting at home one Saturday, and I was just leafing through a large coffee table book. And it was the re-release of Norman Mailer's Moonfire, which was sort of his opus about Apollo 11. And I was looking at many images which had been matched with the text, which we're all familiar with, I think. The lunar surface, Neil Armstrong planting the American flag in the moon, Buzz Aldrin in this sort of NASA marshmallow suit, and turn a page, and all of a sudden I saw this group portrait, and it was a group of wives, as I learned, the Astro Wives, and they were wearing these candy-colored mini dresses and had these skyrocketing beehives, you know, and I sort of had to check myself, you know, am I seeing an outtake from Mad Men Goes to the Moon, or these real-life women? Well, of course, they were. And I became fascinated with them. You know, why have we only caught glimpses of them, you know, in the space stories that we're familiar with, the right stuff in Apollo 13? And I just thought there must be sort of the heart of the space race to be told within their story.
The heart of that's so interesting. As you read the book, you sure get that idea. 50 years after the inception of the space program, you really take for granted how bold and innovative it was, that it felt in the Sputnik era, right? I mean, tell us about that period, that time.
Absolutely. I mean, the whole world was just caught up with, I think, you know, space fever, as it was. I mean, Sputnik was incredibly dramatic, you know, and really put an enormous amount of fear within the whole country. And, you know, Lyndon Johnson said, you know, we don't want to go to sleep by the light of a red communist moon, or words to those effect. And, you know, it was just restless nights. And all of a sudden, in 1959, you have the announcement of the Mercury 7 astronauts, and they are really presented as these silver-suited Cold War warriors who are going to hopefully beat the Russians into space and sort of, you know, ensure America's place back on top, you know. And I think, you know, because of the space race, we now look at the moon almost, you know, as American as apple pie and Coca-Cola, you know.
But in many ways, because of the Mercury 7, I mean, their lives changed overnight. They went from anonymous military pilots to heroes, international heroes, and it was their wives, right? The Astro Wives, as they were called.
They were called that.
Did they name themselves, by the way?
No. You know, astronaut and astrowife were a term that, you know, they even sort of scorned at the time. Not scorned, but, you know, what is it to be an astronaut, you know, a star voyager? What is it to be an astrowife? But all of a sudden, these women were like America's first reality stars. And they went from being unknown women, military wives, living on sort of drab base housing around the country, to all of a sudden being on the cover of Life magazine.
So did they go willingly or reluctantly, Lily?
Well, it really depends woman to woman. You know, if you look at pictures of them, they all sort of look like your perfect jello mold 1950s housewife at the outset. But I think what the book reveals is just what a diverse group they were. There was Annie Glenn, the wife of John Glenn, first American to orbit the Earth. And she was sort of your scoop of vanilla ice cream. And that's why she was the ultimate astrowife, because she sort of gave what NASA demanded, which was this squeaky, clean image.
We have some sound of her, Lily. Let me play it now that you bring her up. This is great. In 2010, here is Annie Glenn, wife of John Glenn, giving an interview to the John Glenn School of Public Affairs at Ohio State. Here she is talking about how scared she was about her husband's trip to space.
I never even heard the word astronaut. I had to learn how to spell that word. I didn't think we should be going out to into God's heaven. I mean, I just think he would never make it back. Then it came time for him, and then his launch kept being postponed. I forget how many times it was postponed. And when it finally came, I was scared to death.
Scared to death. So many emotions. I mean, at the beginning of that, I'd never heard the word astronaut. I had to learn how to spell it. And here she was in the middle of this firestorm. Help us understand the attention that came being married to one of these astronauts.
It was intense. And like we said, it happened overnight. So these women, as one of them said, it was as if I was living my life on a dark stage and suddenly somebody turns on the spotlight. And that spotlight didn't leave them very intensely for the next decade. And for formidable women like Annie Glenn, as you can see, she's still somewhat in the public eye. But this meant that when their husbands were picked as Mercury 7 astronauts, Life magazine purchased the rights for their exclusive stories for $500,000, which was really incredible at the time. So they almost did become like these first reality stars. Reporters were embedded in their homes, photographers. So there was always a life reporter and photographer with a wife during the mission. And it was really seen, I think, by both the wives themselves as well as the press, is not only his launch, hubby's launch, but it was her launch too. And some of the wives, including Jane Dreyfuss, who was married to Pete Conrad, who we're going to be speaking to, she even phrased it as feeling like her own personal countdown that, you know, was happening within her body and mind, and just the whole stress of having your husband ride on what was essentially a large stick of dynamite or a bomb and going where few or none had ever gone before.
Right, and keeping the home fires burning, you know, I mean, there was a lot of pressure from NASA, frankly. You know, I think the phrase was, if you don't have a happy marriage, we don't have a happy space flight.
If you don't, you don't have a space flight at all, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the original couples, Trudy and Gordo Cooper, promptly got together for the sake of the space race. They had been separated beforehand. And, you know, Gordo knew there was no chance of him being picked if he didn't have a little wife back at home. So these women sort of had to keep cool, calm, and composed while dealing with an enormous amount of stress, not only of your husband, you know, having a day job of riding rockets, but, like you mentioned, the press. And overnight, your lawn would be transformed into, you know, a television set, networks erecting their television transmission towers, the press camped out on your lawn. And it got so bad that, you know, press would sort of peek over the backyard fences trying to catch a shot of an Astro kid floating in the pool once the program moved to Houston, to the sort of space suburbia, which was known as Togethersville at the time.
America's first reality families, right? But these women, in all seriousness, were knitted together. Forget the attention outside. They were knitted together in bonds of friendship, and they took care of each other during a very difficult period.
They were, and they came from all across the country and different walks of life. Joe Shura, who is married to Wally Shura, an early one of the Mercury astronauts, she was sort of Navy royalty. She had grown up overseas in Shanghai and really brought a sense of sort of refinement and that perfect Navy wife sensibility to the group. Then there was Annie Glenn, who, as she spoke about in that clip, you know, really had some spiritual concerns that much of the country related to as well. When John was picked to go into space, she actually went to her minister and asked him if it was okay for John to explore God's heavens, you know, and he assured her it was, you know, so she got behind it. There was Reen Carpenter, who was this beautiful, blonde, vivacious part of the group.
JFK is proclaimed fame. Right, I was just going to say it.
Yes, JFK would say, you know, how he found her the most attractive of the astronaut wives. And, you know, she got to go to the White House and have sort of a tete-a-tete with Jackie Kennedy, which was sort of the ultimate goal for many of these women after their husbands came down. But, you know, you have this diverse group that is thrust in this crazy new, brave new world together, and they had to just figure out what exactly an astronaut wife was. And they didn't get much support from NASA, and they sort of felt like persona non grata down at Cape Canaveral, but they banded together and realized there was no other way they would survive without being there for each other.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about the Astronaut Wives Club, the wives of America's first astronauts. Here is the sound of the launch of Apollo 12 on November 14, 1969, as broadcasted by NBC News. On board are astronauts Pete Conrad, Richard Gordon, and Alan Bean.
10, 9, 8, ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Zero. All engines running. Commit. Liftoff. We have liftoff. 11:22 a.m. Eastern Standard Time.
And there it went, Apollo 12. Joining me this hour, Lily Capel. She's author of the new book, The Astronaut Wives Club, A True Story. And joining me now, Jane Dreyfuss, formerly Jane Conrad. She was married to Pete Conrad, Gemini astronaut, Apollo 12 commander, and the third man to walk on the moon. Jane Dreyfuss, thank you so much for being with us.
You're welcome, Jane.
So what was it like to hear that just now, that clip, all these years later? Your husband going up in Apollo 12. What was that like for you?
Well, it brought a lot of memories back. At that moment that this happened, the liftoff, I was out on the Banana River in a boat with my parents and with the Life magazine reporter. And we were watching, of course, very intently. And seconds after it lifted off the pad, it was struck by lightning.
Mm.
We could see the lightning.
Mm. And what did you think?
I didn't know what to think. Of course, we had a radio on board, and we could hear NASA talking, and so we thought, well, this is probably the end of the flight, at the very least. And then pretty soon, I heard Pete's voice saying, he said, all the buses have dropped out, which means they lost all their instruments. And then he said, Alan, you put them back in again. So Alan went right to work and got all the things going again. And the next thing we heard was, we're go for the mission.
Mm. So is that a roller coaster of emotions? Your husband's up in space. This is such a new endeavor, a new effort for this country, space agency, NASA. I mean, just brand new. What was that like for you?
Well, it was very exciting and almost seems unreal now that I look back through the years. It just seems as though, how could that have happened? But of course it did.
We've been talking about the celebrity nature of the wives of the Mercury 7 astronauts. You are a Gemini astronaut's wife, as I understand this correctly. What was the relationship like between the wives of all these different astronauts on these different missions, the Mercury astronauts and the Gemini astronauts?
Well, we were not as close until much later because of the first seven wives had been in Houston for a while, and they sort of knew the ropes. They were very gracious to us and said if we had any questions to ask them. But we got to know the ones that lived in our particular neighborhood quite well.
And what was it like to become a celebrity almost overnight, to have the press and the public so closely scrutinizing your life and your marriage, as Lily Coppell so nicely explains in this book?
Well, it was a bit dazzling, I have to admit. We never expected anything like that. Being a Navy wife, we certainly had nothing of that kind. But in a way, it was fun.
And how different was your public persona from that of what you were really going through behind the scenes?
Well, I hope it was the same. Well, actually, no. I was not able to say I was absolutely paralyzed because I wanted to sound very brave.
What was your reaction, Jane Dreyfuss, when women eventually joined the ranks of the astronauts, when Sally Ride made that first flight for an American woman? What were your thoughts?
You go, Sally. I was so proud and so happy.
Lily Coppell, jump in here. I mean, these wives, Jane and others, talked about, actually they referred to these launches as death watches. It was quite something, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think it was terrifying, and I think each woman dealt with it on her own terms. I mean, some women, to me, like Jane and one of her best friends, Marilyn Lovell, who she's been friends with since Pete and Jim were in the same test pilot class. I really see them as optimists among the group. But for some women, the fear could be crushing. Susan Borman had a very difficult time, especially during Apollo 8, which was the first mission to orbit the moon very dramatically over Christmas 1968. And the flight director, Chris Kraft, had come to her home, and she asked him to please level with her and tell her the odds of their chances of making it back. And he told her the flight had a 50-50 chance. And she was sort of crushed under this weight. And she even started writing Frank's eulogy while he was orbiting the moon, so afraid that he might actually die while he was up there. But Jane and Marilyn, to me, they really, they just really didn't allow themselves to go there. And some women didn't. And it sort of, they're all incredibly tough and resilient group. They really have the right stuff, in my opinion. And, that's why I believed so fervently in their story and why I think it's so important for it to be part of history and be something on everybody's shelf, because it is the other side of the incredible human cost and emotional cost of what it took to land Americans on the moon.
The Apollo 1 fire is one of the first NASA tragedies. Remind us of what happened there, Lily.
Well, Apollo 1 was really NASA's first major tragedy. I do want to mention that there were 8 astronauts lost on the path to the moon. Apollo 1 really shocked everyone because it didn't happen in space. It didn't even happen in the air in one of these jet trainers the guys rode called T-38s to the Cape, which sort of always worried the wives. But this was when the Apollo 1 capsule combusted. It was a pure oxygen environment, and it burst into flames, and 3 astronauts, Gus Grissom, Ed White, and Roger Chaffee, suffocated and burned to death on the ground in 1967. And we can probably let Jane jump in here, but an enormous amount of responsibility went to the wives when any astronaut was lost, because it was NASA protocol that her friends and neighbors come to the widow's house. But until a man or a representative from NASA could arrive with the official word, all of the wives sort of had to just act as if nothing was wrong.
Jane Dreyfuss, can you tell us about those moments?
Well, that was a difficult thing to do because when Charlie Bassett and Elliot C. were killed in a plane accident, I had this phone call and said, would you go over to, a call from NASA, would you go over to Marilyn C.'s house? she lived across the street from me, and they gave me the news about Elliot, but they said, do not tell her anything, just act normal. And so I had to wait over there just making small talk and pretending that nothing was wrong until the NASA representative came to tell her. And then I had to call Elliot's sister because I had gone to camp with her and nobody else knew her, so I had to call and give her the sad news.
Now I'm going to take a call here, Lily. Here's Mark in Hartford, Connecticut. Mark, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. I wanted to ask the astronaut wives how they felt about their portrayal in some popular movies and media, like From the Earth to the Moon, as they dealt with things that were common in the 60s, like divorce and just their overall portrayal in the film.
Good question, Mark. Thank you. Jane Dreyfuss?
Well, I think you saw the Apollo 13 movie, and I think that was very well portrayed for all the characters, and particularly the wife, because the actress came and lived with Marilyn Lovell for I don't know how long, but anyway, she absolutely had it down cold. She had her exactly like Marilyn. She even had the costume department take some of Marilyn's dresses that she wore back in the day and made replicas of them for the actress to wear in the movie.
Lily Capel, how do you see the TV and movie portrayals Mark mentioned, especially related to, you know, some of the more sensitive issues related to, you know, happy marriages and divorce?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, we've sort of seen, you know, shadows and tips of the iceberg of the astronaut wife. But, you know, each woman was such a distinct character within herself. Many of the space films are still very much sort of portraying the echoes of that early Life magazine coverage where you had to be the perfect Boy Scout and have the perfect Girl Scout wife. And, you know, there are definitely moments that pushed through that. And I love both The Right Stuff and Apollo 13. But we really haven't seen the full sort of bouquet of these women's personalities beyond their motto, which was back in the day, happy, proud, and thrilled, which was sort of the role they had to play in the media's eyes and in NASA's eyes.
Here's Jacqueline in Dorchester, Massachusetts. Hi, Jacqueline. Welcome to On Point. Thanks for calling.
You know, the question I have is, I have been one of the first women lawyers in law firms, and the wives usually had these tea parties while the men went off and had brandy and talked law until my husband, and they sent my husband off to have tea with the wives. My question is, what happens when there are women astronauts and you're considered the woman lawyer, the woman individual is considered the work wife, and the husband is one of the girls? How did they handle that when they started having women astronauts?
Jacqueline, thank you very much. How do you think life is different for spouses today, not just for wives, for spouses, Jane Dreyfuss?
Well, I think it probably goes in the reverse. I think when the wives, the woman astronaut is in space, the husband is taking care of the children. He's probably staying home from work, and he's sitting there biting his nails in front of the television, just like the wives used to do.
Lily Capel?
And I think that families today at NASA definitely have a lot more support than they had back in the day. I mean, the astronaut wives, Jane included, and all of the women that I've portrayed in the book, they were really like our pioneer women. You know, space was seen as the final frontier, and we were making our first foray into it. So, you know, there was no such thing as a support group or, you know, formal introduction of what exactly to do by NASA. That's why these women did have to rely on each other and sort of figure it out alone and stake out new territory together. Even things like going to a psychiatrist was seen as taboo back in the day and could hurt your husband's chances, or that's at least how it was seen, of getting a space flight. There could sort of be no cracks in the facade. And I think we live in a world today where, you know, we encourage those cracks to come out and, you know, let's talk about it and let's make things better. But back then it was very much, you know, just smile and say you're happy, proud, and thrilled, but don't disclose your fears to anyone, even your closest friends.
One of the poignant passages of the book, Lily, is when one of the wife's children develops leukemia, and they rally around her and help her fill her, refrigerator with food and such. I mean, they really helped each other and rallied around each other. Jane Dreyfuss, do you remember moments like that?
Oh, I certainly do. They've always been very, very helpful, especially during the flights. I remember one funny story, though, that happened when our house was full of people and they'd brought lots of flowers and lots of food. And it had just so happened that the swimming pool cleaner came and knocked on the back door, and my NASA security man went to the door, and the pool man said, "Is Mr. Conrad home?" And the security man looked up at the sky and pointed to the sky, and he said, "He's up there." And the guy looked around, the pool man looked around, he saw all these flowers, he saw all the food, and he said, oh, I'm so sorry. He thought it was a funeral.
He needs to do his homework.
Yeah, he needed to listen to the radio.
What did you think, Jane Dreyfuss, about the space program today, that we've not gone back to the moon since 1972? Is that something you'd like to see?
Well, I hope it continues. I just wish we had enough money to do what we want to do, but there are other pressing issues that need money, probably more. I don't know. I really want to continue the space program, though.
And how much do you keep in touch with the other astronaut wives from those days?
We have reunions about every 2 years, and, of course, we email and talk to each other in between times. And the reunions are really wonderful. We find fun places to go, like we might go on a cruise, and we renew old friendships and memories and have a great time.
NASA just announced yesterday, Lily Coppell, 8 new astronauts, its first new batch in 4 years, the first female fighter pilot to become an astronaut in nearly 2 decades, a female helicopter pilot also in the group. 4 of the 8, as I said, are women, the highest percentage of female astronaut candidates ever selected by NASA. Times have changed, have they not, Lily Coppell?
They absolutely have. And, you know, when some people first hear, you know, the story of the Astronaut Wives Club, they think, wow, this is really pre-feminist era. They were being the happy housewife at home. As Reen Carpenter, who I mentioned was very outspoken, JFK's favorite, said to me, you know, we were career military wives, entertaining machines, eyes glued to our husbands' careers. But then you see this incredible arc about how all of these women, Reen and Jane included, sort of launched, I think, as modern American women. At the beginning, they were expected to play this very conventional role and just be sort of the arm candy next to their astronaut. But as you have, you know, women's lib emerge and we're going to the moon, that sort of bubble world that NASA created sort of starts to explode as well. And Reen starts writing an opinionated women's column and goes on to host a feminist talk show. And Jane and her friends sort of launch into new honesties with each other, which continue to develop today.
Mm. Well, Lily Coppell, appreciate your time today. She is the author of the new book, The Astronaut Wives Club. Thanks for being with us. Really appreciate it. An interesting insight.
Thank you so much.
And Jane Dreyfuss, formerly married to Pete Conrad, commander of the Apollo 12 mission in 1969, the third man to walk on the moon. Thanks for all your sacrifices from your family and beyond. Jane, thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
When we come back, it's the 30th anniversary of Sally Ride becoming America's first woman in space. So we'll look back further to the Mercury 13, the would-be female astronauts at the very dawn of the space age. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. It's been 30 years since Sally Ride became America's first woman in space. 50 since Valentina Tereshkova went up for the Soviet Union. We're looking back even further to the Mercury 13, a group of women who underwent intensive testing and wanted badly to be America's first female astronauts. Are women in space the new normal, we're asking this hour? You can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us now, Martha Ackman. She's author of The Mercury 13, The True Story of 13 Women and the Dream of Spaceflight. She's pushing for the surviving members of the Mercury 13, the women who underwent and passed many of the same tests given to Mercury astronauts, to receive the Congressional Gold Medal. Martha Ackman, welcome to On Point.
Good to be with you, Jane.
So who exactly were the so-called Mercury 13?
Well, their names, and I think it's important to say their names because so many people don't know them. They were women who were secretly tested to be astronauts just at the same time as the Mercury 7 men. They were identical twins, Jan and Marion Dietrich, Wally Funk, Bernice Stedman, Jean Hickson, Myrtle Cagle, Sarah Gorlick, Rhea Hurley, Irene Leverton, Janora Stumba, Jerry Sloan, and the wife of Michigan Senator Phil Hart, Jane Hart.
Were they as qualified as their male counterparts?
They certainly showed it in passing the tests. In the your opening segment about the astronaut wives, you played a clip of Dr. Randy Lovelace introducing the Mercury 7 men. He was head of life sciences for NASA, the medical wing. And right after he ran the tests on the Mercury men and helped choose them, he had this astonishing idea. What would happen if we took a group of top flight women pilots and gave them the same tests? And 25 were invited, 18 came to take the tests, and 13 passed. So that's a pretty high percentage.
Mm. These women, the Mercury 13, were trained in secret. Tell me about that.
Yes, it was Randy's idea that if the world knew about it, that it might shoot down his experiment before he even got it off the ground. So he made each of the women pledge secrecy. And you can imagine they couldn't tell their bosses where they were going for 2 weeks at a time. They some even took it to the extreme of not even telling their family. Rhea Hurley was a farm girl from Minnesota, and she was the one that didn't tell her family. They didn't find out until they opened up Life magazine some 3 years later and saw their daughter, a photograph of their daughter, as secretly being tested to go into space.
Mm. So they were tested. They were training there. Some outperformed the men, actually.
Yes, there were three phases of tests. The first phase was medical, to see if they were strong enough to go into space. Second phase was psychological. Did they have the guts? And the third phase was spaceflight simulation tests. And on any number of them, some grueling physical endurance tests, the women outpassed the men.
Mm. You mentioned Dr. Randall Lovelace, the NASA consultant. He summoned these women to New Mexico, as you talk about, in 1960. He was curious, right, to see if the female pilots could measure up. What exactly did he find?
Well, at that time, there was great concern about lifting the Mercury space capsule. And as a result, every ounce mattered. He believed that women generally weighed less, consumed less oxygen. They might make better astronauts. Some even said that women's inclination to passivity might make them good astronauts for being in that Mercury space capsule. So some of the tests he gave were electrical stimulation to the nerves, swallowing 3 feet of rubber hose for gastric analysis, brain wave measurements. The worst test, I think, that the women endured, at least that they reported really hating, was a test to see how well they could respond to what they thought would be the great dizziness of space. So they injected their inner ears with ice-cold water, and it sent their balance haywire. Their eyes actually oscillated left, right, left, right, left, right, and they had to measure how quickly they would come back to stability. Mm. It was another kind of interesting thing about the test that a lot of people don't recognize. It was the first thorough medical exams on healthy women. Prior to that, the exams would measure heart disease or something like that. But John Glenn himself said these were the most thorough tests ever given to mankind and womankind as well.
Martha, continue the story here. These women were physically, psychologically fit for space. But they had to convince NASA that women had the right to be astronauts, right?
Right. At the 11th hour, just as the women were to begin spaceflight simulation tests down at the Pensacola Naval Air Training Facility, the Navy got cold feet, and they said, we really need NASA's official approval before we can allow the women to use the equipment. Interesting that women were taxpayers, of course. They were paying for that equipment. But the Navy petitioned NASA, and NASA then got cold feet. And they said, no, we're going to pull the plug on this. We see this as Randy Lovelace's independent experiment. And they thought that if they lost a woman in space, that that would derail the space movement. Maybe for decades to come. Many thought women were not qualified. The editorial cartoons on the secret program were, once it became known, were really mind-boggling. There was a space capsule that had little tie-back frilled curtains with a woman in it saying, I don't know what this gizmo does to get the spacecraft right. I mean, all kinds of stereotypes about women's intelligence. So NASA scrapped the program, but that's an interesting moment in the story because it could have been that the women simply went home, but they didn't. They raised Cain, and Jerry Cobb, the leader of the group, went to Washington, D.C., and that's where the question changed from being a scientific one, are women equipped to go into space, to being a political one, do they have the right?
And there's a congressional hearing on the issue, was there not?
Yes. Actually, before that, the women went to Vice President Lyndon Johnson, who was head of the Space Council. Jerry Cobb and Jane Hart had that meeting. And unbeknownst to them at the time, LBJ had written on a letter to the head of NASA, James Webb. He wrote, let's stop this now. He was another one who wanted to put an end to it. But they didn't give up at that point. Then they forced a congressional hearing, 3 days of hearings. Actually, the third day was cut short. But the 2 days of hearings where John Glenn testified, Scott Carpenter testified. They had just come down from their orbits. And Jane Hart and Jerry Cobb. Jerry Cobb's first sentence to that congressional hearing always stays with me, I think, because it's so strikingly simple. She said, we seek a place in our nation's space future without discrimination. That seems to apply to a lot of other situations as well.
And how long would it take before the U.S. would send a woman to space?
It would take another 20 years, over 20 years, about 21 years, when Sally Ride launched on this day 30 years ago.
Let's hear some sound of that, actually. 30 years ago today, STS-7 launching into space, Sally Ride becoming the first American woman to fly there.
T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6. We go for main engine start. We have main engine start and ignition and liftoff of STS-7 and America's first woman astronaut. And the shuttle has cleared the tower.
And here is Sally Ride in 1984 in an interview. She said it didn't make a difference in the training or the actual space flight if it was a woman astronaut or a man on the crew.
The women and the men go through exactly the same training. The women and the men do exactly the same jobs on orbit. And weightlessness is a great equalizer. You don't need to be strong to do things up there. And it's there is really no difference.
But boy, there were women before her who sure paved the way, were there not, Martha?
They certainly were. You know, Eileen Collins was the first woman to be a commander of the space shuttle in 1999. And she found out the story of the Mercury 13 late in life, really, after she was already into the space program. And she once said, imagine what would have happened if those women had not passed those tests. Mm. She said it would have set back women in space a generation.
Here's a call from Wallingford, Connecticut. Steve is on the line. Hi, Steve. I'm so glad you called. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. Nice to talk to you.
Thank you.
It's interesting. This morning I had picked up a magazine that I had in the house, and what I read this morning was about the first female cosmonaut who went up into space. And I'm assuming that was somewhere in the 60s. I'm wondering what kind of impact that had and how that drove the women's program with regard to NASA and trying to promote women in space, even in the earlier years?
Good question, Steve. Thank you. Martha?
That's right. Valentina Tereshkova became the first woman in space in 1963, 3 years after the Mercury 13 women were being secretly tested. Many in NASA put down that launch. They called it a stunt. They said it was like sending up a monkey or a dog into space. They denigrated women even more, you know, by saying it didn't matter, it wasn't important. There were also lots of myths about her being hysterical in the space capsule and unable to control herself. I think other ways of saying that she wasn't on the par with some of the male astronauts. That wasn't across the board, however, that point of view. There were those like Brandi Lovelace, such a champion and pioneer in this whole story, who saw her flight is very important and really underscoring what he was trying to do.
Hmm. Talk about the glass ceiling in aviation today. In NASA and beyond, I think a quarter of the nation's 154 astronauts are women. Give us some statistics. Talk about how far women have come.
Well, we've certainly passed that hurdle in barring women from being astronauts. Back in the day of the Mercury 13, when they had that congressional hearing in 1962, Congress decided that all women would continue to be chosen from the ranks of military jet test pilots. And because women were barred from being military pilots, they were therefore barred from being astronauts. So that has changed. Women can be jet test pilots. Eileen Collins was one of those early jet test pilots.
Right.
So
that's
it's
right.
Continuing to improve. And as you pointed out earlier in the earlier segment, that this current class is 50% women. So that's pretty good news.
Hmm. Let's go to the phones. Anne is on the line from Deerfield, Massachusetts. Anne, welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. You mentioned at the top of this story that Martha Ackman was pursuing a congressional gold medal, perhaps, for the Mercury 13. And I was wondering where she is in that process and if listeners can help.
Anne, thank you very much. Martha Ackman.
Well, the Congressional Gold Medal is a civilian award to Americans who have, to a large degree, kicked in doors. Among the recipients of the Congressional Gold Medal are the Little Rock 9, Tuskegee Airmen, the women Air Force service pilots. And I think that the Mercury 13 certainly qualify for that as well. They were the ones that at least rattled the door, if not kicked it in, for Sally Ride and hundreds of women astronauts to follow. So we hope that we can gain the attention of the United States Congress, writing to your congresswomen, your congressmen, and urging them to get behind the support of awarding the Mercury 13, the Congressional Gold Medal. It'd be great if we had the support of Hillary Clinton, who herself wanted to be an astronaut, and I think even got a letter saying, sorry, Charlie, the women aren't being accepted as astronauts. Hillary Clinton, Michelle Obama, it would be great to have their support as well.
Talk to us about what the Mercury 13 women are doing today. Is still around?
Well,
it's still alive?
Some of them are. 10 of the Mercury 13 are still around, about, I think, 8 or 9 are in pretty good shape. You know, they had some very interesting lives after the testing. Janie Hart, I mentioned earlier, the wife of Senator Phil Hart, got a letter shortly after the secrecy was removed about the testing from a woman in New York saying, a few of us are getting together and we're trying to push women's rights forward. We'd be happy if you would join us. That was Betty Friedan. And Jane Hart became one of the founders of the National Organization for Women. Bee Stedman was one of the founders of the International Women's Aerospace Museum in Cleveland. Wally Funk, the youngest of the Merc 13, went on to become the first woman NTSB FAA investigator. So they'd done a lot of notable things.
What personally do you take from the stories that you've researched and the women that you've spoken to from Mercury 13? What are the lessons about what they went through that most stick with you?
Well, a not uncommon question that I often get is, were they bitter? And I have to say, spent many, many hours with these women and members of their families, and they are not. I think I might have been. But they take great pride in playing a role in opening that door. And I think in all walks of life, pioneers who have done that hard work and opened the door that they might not have been able to walk through but kept it open for others is an important lesson to remember.
Hmm. Well, thank you very much for your time, for your research, and for sharing it with us today, Martha Ackman, the author of The Mercury 13, The True Story of 13 Women and the Dream of Spaceflight. She's pushing for the surviving members of the Mercury 13 who underwent and passed these many tests, same as the men, but didn't get up there to receive congressional gold medals. Thank you very much, Martha Ackman.
Thanks, Jane.
You can continue the conversation, listeners, and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Our program is produced by Emily Johnson, Catherine Brewer, Julie Jopp, Sam Gail Rosen, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsanis, James Ross, and Dean Russell. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. Coming up tomorrow, Sir Ken Robinson, who gave the most watched TED Talk ever, tells us how to find what really makes us tick and get the most out of life and work. That's coming up tomorrow. We'll see you then. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.